Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, my guest is Rosemary Ringer. But before I bring her on, I have to thank C60 Purple Power, the most amazing super antioxidant, free radical eliminating solution for your health. I feel great, and you really should too. Click the link in the description to learn more. Check it out for yourself. Or you can visit c60purplepower.com. If you place an order, use coupon code KNOWLEDGE10, and you get 10% off plus free shipping. And you don't want to miss that. Also, the other announcement that I have for tonight is that we are going to be relocating. And if you would like to assist with that in any way, any donations would be greatly appreciated. But not only that, if you make a donation of $10 or more, you're going to get 3 months free to our premium video site. If you make a donation of $25 or more, you're going to get a copy of Corey Hughes' new JFK book. It's going to be an amazing read. So if you guys would love to help out and leave a donation, we greatly appreciate that. Also, we're still working on our new premium site. And the most important information for our announcements tonight is that YouTube is doing a purge. We've all talked about it before, and I'm pretty sure my channel is on the purge list. So we are preparing for this in every way possible. We're moving to BitChute. Everything is already on LBRY, our library.com. We have, of course, the podcast. They're not messing with our podcast yet. So on all popular podcast platforms, we're always available. But as far as video, we're looking for different alternatives to YouTube, of course. So we will be on BitChute, we'll be on LBRY, and we'll have our own platform that we're rolling out soon. So just be prepared, guys, for when that happens, because, you know, I'm pretty sure it will happen. It's been happening to all of my friends' channels, many, many people that I know. So it's coming, and it's just a matter of time. So be on the lookout, and you know where to find me. So we'll keep you updated with everything going on with that. Now, tonight, I want to welcome to the show Rosemary Ringer. For 20 years, she enjoyed a national reputation as an expert on old houses. She is the author of 9 books. She has been featured on everything from PBS History Detectives to BBC Radio. In 2016, her husband committed suicide, and 2 years later, she was diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. After a routine medical procedure, Rose bled to death. Now, in heaven, she was told that if she agreed to return to Earth, she'd be restored to wholeness. Subsequently, medical tests affirmed that not only had the disease disappeared, but she was also healed of the crippling grief. Rosemary, welcome. How are you doing tonight?
Thank you. Well, it's cold and chilly here in the Midwest. We had 36 degrees and 3 steady days of rain, so I'm ready for that to end.
Oh, I bet. Wow, yeah, it's still kind of warm down here in Louisiana, but I hope it gets a little better weather for you soon.
Well, I'm sure by spring it'll be swell.
Yeah, hope so. Now, I'm looking forward to tonight. Now, your story, I've heard many like it, and the possibilities of the afterlife that come with an experience like this, especially experiences so profound as yours, it provides what I consider to be very good evidence that there is something more than our physical lives. There is something more than our physical manifestations here. And I want to get into your story and where it starts. I can imagine it was very devastating for you. I can't imagine the emotional devastation of a spousal loss, especially a suicide. Now, I'd like to start in the beginning where everything started for you.
The thing is, having told this story more than a few times, people just want to hear what heaven was like. And yet part of the story, a significant part of the story, a big part of the story, is surviving my husband's suicide. They say that the death of a spouse by suicide is one of the most severe and devastating traumas a human being can experience. In fact, I saw a study done by the American Psychiatric Association that likened it to surviving a concentration camp experience. So this is about as horrible a thing as can happen to a human being, because it's not just the death and the loss and all the et ceteras that go with the loss of a spouse, but the violence, and all the et ceteras that go with it is, and I've actually just finished writing a book about this. The title is Remembering the Light, How Dying Saved My Life. But one of the things I talk about within its pages is only with, suicide really is a death like no other. And it is only in suicide, that loss of a spouse to that, that the spouse, in this case me, the wife, gets questioned by the cops. And you know, when your husband dies of a disease process, you aren't interrogated as to where were you? What was the nature of your last discussion? What were you arguing about? It's horrible. And I hopefully in our enlightened age, there'll be a day when we look back at this time and realize that just like rape victims of the 1960s, we don't, you know, we used to ask rape victims, what were you wearing? Why were you out? Why were you at a bar at that hour? And we're still doing that with suicide widows. You know, women who survive the death of a spouse to suicide really don't need to go through that as well. And in the larger picture, as society really does ostracize us because, you know, it's terrifying. It's a trauma. And one of the most frequently asked questions I get was there a note? And what that really means, you know, did he leave behind a note? What that really means is, can you tell me why this happened? Because I want to make sure it never happens to me. And the trauma and the stigma of suicide in so-called enlightened 21st century America is very severe. I was an author. I had some success as an author. I traveled frequently promoting my books and doing other things. My husband was a litigator. You know, we lived in a beautiful house in a beautiful place. We didn't have financial worries. And I went from that to actually, I lost my mind. I lost about 40 pounds of weight. I became emaciated. And for a very brief time, a handful of days, I was living out of my car. And only because I couldn't get comfortable anywhere. I just felt like a wounded animal. And, you know, the thing that saved me, there were two people in my life, but one of them lived out on a farm in a rural part of Virginia. And she found out that I was pretty happy about being in my car. I said, you know, I finally got comfortable. I finally found a place where I'm comfortable. And she said, you are not going to live out of your car. You're coming home with me. And that woman took care of me for 4 months. And had it not been for that, I would have been lost. And then there was another friend who stepped in and he said, my family, my loved ones, I should say, they didn't know what to do with me. And so they thought perhaps a psychiatric ward would be a good thing. And it was all out of love. You know, their motives were the highest and the best and the purest. But my second friend, his name is Milton, he said that she won't survive that. She'll find a way to end her life. So my point is, we lose so many people to drug addiction and homelessness and all the trauma and horrors. And had it not been for these two people, I have no doubt I would have also been lost. Because I was on a pretty fast downhill slide. And September was Suicide Prevention Month in America, which sets my hair on fire. Because every time I hear somebody talk about suicide prevention, what I hear is, you know, coulda, woulda, shoulda. There's something more there must have been signs. There's something you could have done. There, you know, man like that, you would have seen something. Nope, 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 not true. And we do blame the victim. I just heard somebody today say laughingly, well, yeah, that guy did kill himself, but look at his wife. I've been to suicide meetings, suicide survivor meetings. This is what we're known as, suicide survivors. And I heard a woman say, my son would still be alive if it wasn't for that woman, his wife. So yeah, the wife gets the blame. And it is between the guilt we feel by ourselves and the guilt that is heaped upon us, it is horrific. And if we really want to have a serious conversation in this country about suicide prevention, the place to start is looking at the suicide survivors. Depending on whose statistics you believe, those of us who survive suicide, the spouses and the parents, are 12 to 40 times more likely to end our own life. Think about that. We now have an identified group of people that are at significant risk of ending their life. And what do? We ostracize them. We make sure they stay at arm's length. We treat them like lepers. And I speak from some experience on this. And ultimately, as I started to get a little better, people came back into my life and showed me great kindness. But man, oh man, we have got to come out of the dark ages on how we deal with suicide survivors. There's nothing. Suicide prevention is something we do and talk about to make other people feel better. And who knows? I am not a mental health worker, nor am I an expert in that field, but I'm speaking as somebody who has been through this trauma. It is hard to describe and imagine what happens to somebody. I mean, look how far and fast I fell from being a successful author married to a successful lawyer to living out of a car. And by the way, that only took about 6 weeks. So that's, sometimes I say, don't get me started, but there really are no words to describe what suicide does to people. So with that as the backdrop, my husband ended his life April 2016. And then it was actually 29 months later, I was having a lot of very unpleasant physical symptoms. And then one day I started having, I started bleeding and I didn't know what was going on. I went to a gynecologist and they did some tests and they found out I had cervical cancer and they sent me to an oncologist, gynecological oncologist. And he examined me and he said it had advanced to a point where the flesh was actually distorted. And they were going to do a specific biopsy to figure out how far this had spread. You know, were we at stage one or stage four? Where were we? Nobody really knew.
Right.
So that was, it was that biopsy that was the first surgery I'd ever had, my first hospitalization for anything other than childbirth. I had three babies. And I was 59 years old at the time. And woke up from that. It was a little quick 30-minute procedure. Woke up from that. And, you know, they want you out the door, out the door, out the door. So they told me get up and get dressed and, you know, go to the bathroom, get myself together. And I came back from that. And I said, hey, I am bleeding profusely. And the RN who attended me said, oh, once you get home and lie down in your own bed, you'll feel a lot better. So two more times I told her that I was indeed bleeding profusely. And each time she was very dismissive. So like a good little patient, I went on home. And by the time I got home, I was a mess. I mean, I had made a mess of the car. I'd made a mess of all the clothes. I bled through everything. And I went and got in my shower. I had a nice white tiled walk-in shower. And I realized, being I guess, a typical neat freak, I had white carpet in my house. I didn't want to mess up the house. So I thought, okay, I'll just stand in the shower and bleed to death. That way I won't make a mess. Because you know, when you're bleeding out, the most important thing is not messing up the carpet. Yeah, I do remember. Yeah, true story. I do remember standing in that shower and just watching this blood pour out of my body. And I remember thinking, you know, for 29 months, you have suffered the torments of the damned. You have been dragged through hell backwards. Your light, you have asked God every night. I ask God three things. One, either heal me or let me die. Let me die in my sleep. I can't do this anymore. I fought off horrific suicidal temptations constantly. It was unrelenting. I couldn't see any way out of this hell except taking my own life. And I was constantly begging God, help me, please help me. Don't let me do to my children what he did to me. My other prayer was, when I die, spare me the life of you. And every now and then people will chuckle at that, but I meant it. I had had recurring nightmares. My husband did this with a gun in his mouth. I had recurring nightmares that I discovered him just as he was putting the gun in his mouth and pulling the trigger. That happened again and again and again and again. So I had been through this enough. I did not want to see it on a life review. Not to mention I had been through a lot. And as a result of his suicide, I mean, I became addicted to prescription drugs. I began abusing alcohol. I had multiple accidents. I had a lot of physical problems, a whole lot of mental problems. And all that's very typical. Absolutely typical. Absolutely. I was so normal. But then my third prayer was, I couldn't handle any more decisions. As a consequence of his suicide, there'd been a lot of legal nightmares to be resolved, and each one required a heavy decision, a weighty decision. So those are three prayers: heal me or let me die, no life review, and please help me. I can't do any more hard decisions. So then I'm standing in that shower, watching the blood flow out of my body, and I thought, wow, you know what? I have been begging God to either heal me or let me die. And here I am. All I have to do is sit down on the floor of this shower won't be long now. I've already lost a lot of blood. I'm losing it faster and faster. So I, leaning against that shower wall, I knew that if I sat down on the floor of the shower, I wouldn't be getting back up, that it'd be over. Boy, was that appealing. And as I thought about this, I mean, I really gave this some consideration. I had my buddy Milton and his sister who'd come from Ohio to be with me during this surgery. They were right on the other side of this wall, sitting in my living room in my home. And I thought, you know, they love me. They care about me. Do they really need to walk into the master bathroom and see my dead, bled out body? You know, is that really fair to them? And I also thought Milton, again, a dear friend, one of the people who saved me, he's the one who had discovered my husband's body. And there's, the human mind is not really wired to see the kind of things that happen from a gun, from a gunshot wound like that. So I thought about that. And I thought, wow, you know, I can't do that to them. So I decided to push off against that shower wall and walked out in the living room and said, you know, I'm bleeding to death. Call an ambulance. And they did. Ambulance took me to a little standalone ER. At the ER, they made a few more mistakes.
Oh, my.
And it was an Yep. The ER was actually not affiliated with a hospital. I mean, they were affiliated with a hospital, but it was almost like a glorified now care or urgent care center. So they made some boo-boos. And what they did, it's kind of funny now, they stuffed me with gauze. And they stopped seeing the blood, but they didn't stop the bleeding. And then they left me in that room, left me a little ER cubicle. And my buddy Milton stayed by my side, which was a great blessing. So, and then they, shortly before, they had given me some Dilaudid, but shortly before they gave me the Dilaudid for pain, I remember grabbing, an RN, I'm lying on the gurney, and RN's to my left, and I remember grabbing her hand, and I was pretty frightened, and I said, promise me you're not going to let me die. I mean, I knew what was coming. I knew this could go one of two ways. I wasn't sure how this was going to end.
Yeah.
And she said, she was very sweet, very, very solicitous and tender and all that, and she looked in my eyes, she said, oh, honey, we're not going to let you die. We have many solutions for this. I thought, well, that's good. They're on it, you know, they're on it. But then they left the room. They gave me some Dilaudid, and the doctor and the nurse left the room, and Milton, my buddy, was sitting on a little stool by my side. And I had a blood pressure cuff, one of those, I don't know, it's like a blue metal box on a stick that automatically checks your blood pressure every few minutes. And then they had a pulse ox on my finger to check my oxygen levels. So they walk out. They've stuffed me with gauze, and they walk out. Not sure what the plan was, but my buddy said, it didn't take long, and my blood pressure just kept going down, down, down. And he said at one point, he glanced up at that blood pressure cuff, and my blood pressure was 32 over 25, which it turns out is really low.
Yeah.
And not good. And he said, my eyes popped open. I had been unconscious. My eyes popped open. And he said, you tried to sit up on the gurney, which is pretty darn impressive for somebody with a blood pressure of 32 over 25. And he said, you reached up to heaven and you talked to somebody that only you could see. And he said, and after that, and he said, you had your hands out, wiggling your fingers, almost like a child reaching up for her father. And he said, after that, you just flop back on that gurney. And he said, and that's when the blood pressure reading went to error, which probably means it was lower than 32 over 25. And I think that's probably when I left for heaven. And I've heard stories before about people who are dying. And at the end, they have a surge of energy. And I think that's what happened. So meanwhile, I'm having a time of my life. I was in a deep, unconscious, dreamless state at the moment of my death, and I woke up at the moment I died, and I woke up being catapulted out of my body, and I mean catapulted. It was as though there was a silver, sinewy, elastic cord from the crown of my head to the heel of my feet, and somebody had pulled back on it like an archer's bow and released it. And boy, I went popping out of that body like toast out of a toaster. It was incredibly dramatic. And, you know, one of the really so many interesting facets to this, but one of them was I knew what was happening. I knew I had just died. And one of my first thoughts was, boy, this is a surprise. No one saw this coming. And one of my very first thoughts was my heart has stopped. And I thought, how do I know that? I mean, I just said it out loud. My heart has stopped. I thought, I don't know how I know it, but I know that's right. And then another thought was, I'm dying. I mean, I've been a researcher. I've been a newspaper reporter. I've written hundreds of articles, 9 books. Writing is my world. And I've, you know, part of what makes a good writer or reporter effective is being paying attention to their surroundings, taking in everything. So I'm moving through this experience, floating further and further and further away from my body. And I think, you're dying. Or actually, I spoke in the first person. I said, I'm dying. And then I thought, actually, nope, you're not dying. You're dead. And it cracked me up that here I am going to my reward and I'm correcting my tense. And the beauty part of this is I heard myself giggle. I heard my voice sounding just like I sound now, and I heard my unique giggle, and I thought, wow, everything I am, everything I really am has come with me. My macabre sense of humor, my goofball sense of humor, my giggle, my interest in what's happening, my memories. I remembered all of it. I remembered, like I said, I remember thinking, isn't everyone going to be surprised at how this turned out? I remember the medics coming to my house. I remembered that I was facing chemo and radiation. I was supposed to start that in a few days. I mean, it was very, honestly, it felt like somebody was putting 100,000 amps through a 60-amp breaker box. I had the greatest mental acuity that I have ever experienced. Instead of just, you know, when we walk through life, we tend to look at what's in front of us. I felt like I could see everything in front of me, everything behind me, everything beside me. It was phenomenal. It was beyond what words could ever explain.
I'm sure that this was much more vivid and clear than just a dream experience. You could differentiate basically, right?
It was like, it was very clear to me that that waking up from this earth experience was the dream. This was the reality. What I was experiencing. Yeah, that was real. And it was, you know, I had been alive for 59 years and I realized how inconsequential those 59 years had been in the picture of eternity, in the picture of where I was now. And, you know, again, being writers, what is it they say? The difference between being neurotic and psychotic. If you're psychotic, you torment everybody else. If you're neurotic, you torment yourself. And writers are so neurotic. And I mean, I'd always beaten up myself, always so hard on myself. And in this experience, I remember thinking, I've always wondered what I would look like with no fears, no worries, no self-recrimination, no guilt, none of the negative attributes. I've always wondered what I would look like. And I thought, this is it. This is the real me. This is who I really am. And it was just fantastic. And somewhere early on in this experience, I mean, I'm still floating further and further away from my body and so many thoughts coming in every direction. And I felt a massive spiritual presence join me. And I mean, massive. And I turned my head to my left and looked to my left and up, because that's where this being was. And I said, and I'm happy. Honestly, it was the happiest I've ever known, the greatest joy, the greatest peace I've ever known. And I said, and who are you? Literally like that.
And you said you felt the spiritual presence. Could you kind of describe what that felt like? Was it, you know, on top of this joyous feeling you already felt?
Yes, it was. I've heard people who have near-death experiences will often talk about the love they feel. Now, on Earth, I had known the joy for 40 years anyway of a mother that loved me dearly, and that was very precious. But I had not known much about peace in this earthly life, and in this heavenly experience, I suddenly knew what peace was. I had perfect peace. In fact, I thought about the Bible verse very early on. I thought about the Bible verse, the perfect peace that passeth all understanding shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. And I thought, this is what Paul was talking about. This peace, this is perfect peace. And as to the spiritual being, I was floating in blackness. While I knew I was floating and I knew I was getting further and further away from my body, I could not see my body. I could not see what was happening. And I have no doubt that that is God's mercy. Because one, I learned later that when the doctor and nurse came running back in the room, they removed that gauze from my body. And there was a tremendous amount of blood. And then ultimately they used electricity to get my heart started again. So I'm very grateful I did not see that. I really liken it to a merciful parent who says, now, dear, you don't need to see this. So I was floating away in this blackness, and the spiritual being, as to defining it physically, there is no definition. As to defining he, she spiritually, I would say he, she was, and I don't say this irreverently, but perfect. Perfect peace, perfect love, perfect joy, perfect calm. And when I said, and who are you? I mean, I just wanted to know who has joined me, because this is just getting better and better with every moment. And the answer came before I could even finish the sentence. And the answer was, and this was very profound to me, the being told me, you, Rosemary, you are the image and likeness. I'm the original. And that's First Genesis 27. And my whole life, I'd struggled to know what that meant. It says we're made the image and likeness of God. And I had thought about myself as the image and likeness of God, but I'd never thought about the original. And hearing that, you know, you're the image and likeness, I'm the original, I thought, wow. And the best analogy I can give, it felt like I was 1/1,000,000,000th of a drop of water in the ocean. And I was being reunited with my source. I was being reunited with the one that made me. I was being reunited with the original. And you know, what's kind of funny, when I first came back from this experience and, you know, excitedly told everybody everything, I called the original Big Rosemary. And that did not go well with folks. They thought it was blasphemous. And I wasn't, I would never blaspheme, but it was the right. best way I could find to describe it. And I've since thought about it that, you know, there's on Earth right now, there are 6 billion plus image and likenesses. And I think it's like a prism that when you put light through it, the refractions are multitudinous. And I think that's what we are. I think we're all refractions of the original light manifesting in different ways. But meeting the original was so, so fantastic. So this experience is floating in the blackness went on for some time. And I mean, if you told me I'd been dead for 2 weeks, I would have believed it. Time is a very human construct. Even Einstein said to those of us who are committed physicists, the past, present, and future are only illusion, however persistent. And in this experience, there was just now. And while I lay it out as a chronology, do I really know that it happened, you know, A, B, C, D, E, and F? No. I just know what happened. So after a bit, I was, it's like somebody took my batteries out. 1 minute I'm floating in this blackness, having a wonderful time, and now I'm in the presence of the original. And then I don't know the transition, but next thing I'm on my feet. I'm no longer standing. I'm on my feet, and I'm in a large white room. And the ceiling was white, the floors, the walls, the brightest, most brilliant, luminescent, white room. It was so white, it maybe had a touch of blue. You know, it was just the most perfect white light. And the light was coming from the walls and the ceiling and the floor. And in this room, it was a mist falling. It was like a heavy fog, but it wasn't a fog. It wasn't cold or damp. It was immensely comfortable. And not only was it comfortable, it was actively comforting me. And I realized I'm on my feet. But then I think, and this is kind of funny, I thought, do I have feet? And I thought, I don't know. And I really wish I'd looked at my feet. Oh my goodness, do I wish that. But I thought, you know, I don't know if I have feet, but I feel like I can move with intention. Like if I say I want to cross the room, I can. And I could see at the far edge of the room was a door and it was shut. And all my life I have been fascinated by near-death experience stories. And I mean fascinated. And I've read every book I could get my hands on. So I knew what that door meant. I knew that door was crossing the Rubicon, that there was no coming back. And one of the experiences, backing up briefly, in that blackness, when I was floating away, I remembered that I had been in this blackness before. Within my 59-year experience, I remembered it so powerfully. And I asked the being that accompanied me, I said, why do I have a memory of having been here before? And the being said, you remember your mama told you when you were a baby, when you were a newborn infant, you were given up for dead. And you came back from that. You know, my mom went home and prayed and got a friend that prayed. And to everyone's astonishment, I revived. And the angels told me you weren't near death. You did cross over and you were sent back, which I remember thinking for 59 years, I've wondered why I'm so different from everybody. And I thought, you know, that would have been useful information back on Earth, but whatever, we're beyond that. Let's keep going. So I think that helped me understand why I've always been fascinated by these near-death stories. So I'm in this white room and I'm on my feet and I see the door and I know what the door means. And, you know, some people have said, they say, you wanted to come back. Nope. I knew that I was looking at this chemo, this radiation. They said there was a 70% chance the chemo and radiation would kill the cancer. If not, we had to keep repeating the cycles until it was all gone, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't want any part of that. So as I'm in this white room, the predominant feeling I had was gratitude. I just kept saying again and again and again, I am so grateful that this is over. And I also remember thinking, I've always wondered what would take me out, and now it's happened. One less thing to worry about. I mean, we do kind of wonder what's going to take us out. Right. And I really felt like God had heard my prayers, you know, that I had been granted early release for good behavior. You know, I'd been on the rack long enough, 29 months, I'd suffered so much. And I also remember thinking, I didn't do this to myself. You know, this wasn't a suicide. I'm out and I'm out clean. And it just, oh my goodness, I was so profoundly, truly, deeply grateful. So in this white room, I see this door across the room and I realize I have to walk to it. And I am walking. And as I walk, this mist or vapor, whatever, swirling around me. And it was so beautiful. And I remember trying to focus on an individual droplet of this mist, which sounds crazy. I mean, you walk through a fog, you don't try to focus on one of the bits of vapor. And the spiritual being that was with me said, your spiritual eyes have not acclimated to this yet, but what you're looking at, these are particles of light, and they're moving around you and through you, and they're healing you. And what I was told is we cannot go on to heaven. Sometimes people die after a long disease process where they have mental issues or burdens or sadness, and we can't go to heaven with that stuff. So in moving through this white room, all of that's taken away from us and we're restored to our innate original perfection. And I thought, whoa, how cool is that? And that made sense. It didn't feel like vapor, but when I was told it was particles of light, that made so much sense. And each itty bitty tiny droplet of light, and like I say, the size of water vapor, tiny, was, how can I say this? Each little itty bitty piece of light was for the glory of God. It was for God. It was of God and for God and about God. So as I walked across this room, I was just so great. I mean, I wanted to run to that door. I wanted to run to that door and be done with this. And when I got to the door, and it was a process, I can't say if I walked 10 steps or 40 steps, but it was a process. I got to the door and I put my right hand up to push through the door, pretty interested by the fact that I'm right-handed in heaven, right-handed on earth, right-handed in heaven. And I put my right hand up to push through. I mean, I'm just getting ready to move on. And I paused and I said, is this the divine will for my life, that a stupid medical mistake takes me out? Is this how this was supposed to end? And before I could even get, is this the divine, the answer was no, it's not. But whatever you decide, you go with all of God's grace and mercy and blessings and care and love. And I thought, I'll take that deal. I do not need to hear it again. And, looking back, the beauty part of this was that it was the answer to my third prayer of no more hard decisions. Deciding to go to heaven or deciding to stay on earth is a pretty big decision. And yet, as I was preparing to exit, I had a vision, and it was a very intense vision of that nurse who's, promised me she wasn't going to let me die. She was sitting in a hospital supply room surrounded by linens and cleaning supplies and other things. She was sitting in a hospital supply room on a little metal stool, leaning forward with her head in her hands, sobbing uncontrollably and saying, I promised that woman I wasn't going to let her die, and I lost her. And I thought, oh, come on. Don't do this to me.
No.
Please. Yeah, it really got me. And then I thought, well, she's a nurse. She signed up for this. She'll get over it. And because I knew I needed to go. I knew right. I had to. I could not face coming back. And then I didn't just see the nurse. I felt her pain. I felt that agonal grief. And I recognized it as the same pain I had known for 29 months. This wasn't just a woman sobbing. She was hurting. And I realized if I could spare somebody that much pain and regret and sadness, I had to go back. So I put my right hand back to my side and I said, it's kind of funny now, but I said, it's going to ruin that woman's day if I die. And in the blink of an eye, a millisecond, I was back on that gurney. There was no whoosh. There was no moving backwards. I was just back on that gurney with lots of stuff happening around me. And I was in a different room. Apparently, after they revived me, they transferred me to another room. And then there was a lot of excitement going on, lots and lots and lots and lots of excitement. And ultimately, I was transported to a hospital. And, the next morning at that hospital, a doctor came and talked to me. He said, you lost more than 40% of your blood volume. And I said, really? How much more? He said, well, actually, it doesn't matter because after 40%, your heart stops and you die. And they told me that I had gone into VFib and then my heart had stopped. And the human body is kind of amazing. It shuts down the extremities when you're bleeding to death and just tries to preserve the core. But the heart is a pump. And when there's not enough blood volume, it just, apparently it twitches and then it quits. So the fact that backing up, one of the things the angels told me is if I agreed to come back, I would be healed. And I don't know that they really went into detail at that point, but once I was back, I've heard people say after they come back, they're 50% in this world and 50% in that world. I didn't feel that way. I was 95% in that world and I was 5% on earth. And when I came back, the angels talked to me in depth and they said, you will be healed of not just the cancer, but of the crippling emotional pain, because that's what I really needed healing from. I wanted to be dead. I wanted it over. And when I first came back, when I opened my eyes and I'm on that gurney in that little ER, my first thought was not, oh boy, my first thought was, well, crap, this is disappointing. I spent 6 hours bleeding to death. And now I'm back on earth. I want to be in heaven. I want to be in that white room again. I want to be talking to the angels. But the angels were a very palpable presence in those early days. But, you know, the next morning at the hospital, it was actually very gratifying to hear the doctor say, yep, your heart stopped. So when I had said that, when I popped out of my body, that was right. My heart had stopped. And it was very difficult coming back, and I was in the hospital for several days. And something I've subsequently learned is it's hard to bring somebody back from the dead. From bleeding to death, because it's so damaging to the organs. And I learned, it's kind of fascinating, that after your body loses that much blood, the veins and arteries can get sticky, and you can often have catastrophic organ damage or tissue damage, because the blood doesn't just say, oh, let's begin again. You know, our fluids don't rush into all the same places. So they did multiple tests on me at the hospital. And with every test, I would say, we don't need to do this test. The angel said, I'm going to be fine. And they said, well, we're going to do the test anyway. But with every test, you know, the doctor would sit down and say, well, Rosemary, you're a very lucky woman. This is fine. That is fine. This is fine. That is fine. And they thought that I would have significant damage to my heart. In fact, they said I had elevated enzymes in my blood. And so it was evident that I had had a heart attack. And a heart attack was just from the shock of losing all that blood. But they expected my heart muscle to have significant damage, and it was fine. It was absolutely perfect. So, and while that's really cool to come back from, and by the way, I had been without any blood pressure or heartbeat for more than 10 minutes. And the interesting thing is, when somebody dies of bleeding to death, you can't even do CPR, because with every chest compression, you just push out more blood. So there's no medical explanation for me coming back from this. In fact, as soon as I was conscious, I remember the nurse looking in my face and saying, she was right in my face, and she said, what is your name? And I said, Rosemary. She said, what year is it? I said, 2018. And she said, where are you? And I said, a crummy excuse for an ER. But they were very concerned about what they had brought back. After 10 minutes with no blood pressure, no pulse, you know, medically speaking, I should have been a vegetable, because the belief is after 3 minutes, your brain is mush. So it's all pretty dramatic. And in writing my book, I actually interviewed a couple medical folks. One was an ER nurse and one was a doctor. And they had told me that they knew of stories of young people in their 20s who had been brought back after bleeding to death. And in both cases, these young people died within a couple days because of the significant damage to internal organs. And that's pretty typical. So for a 59-year-old woman to come back from this is very, very dramatic. And to come back with no consequences. I mean, it's been over 2 years now, and I'm pretty healthy and pretty active and have absolutely no health issues. So, and then ultimately, I had to find a new oncologist, but ultimately I had a subsequent surgery because, you know, it turns out when doctors hear you bled to death from a simple surgical thing, they get a little nervous around you.
Oh yeah.
But, the original oncologist would not believe that I'd been healed of cancer. When you start telling people the angels said I was healed of cancer, they're like, check the mental illness column on this one.
Right.
So, I had to find another oncologist, and she did a subsequent surgery and took lots and lots and lots of flesh from lots of places, because their model is very rigid. It's very much in this itty bitty little high walled box. And if you're not in that itty bitty high walled box, they don't know what to do with you. But my buddy Milton was waiting for me in the waiting room. And he said, after this second surgery to affirm, you know, what's going on with the cancer, he said she came bursting through the doors and threw her arms around his neck and said, she's right. She said, her flesh is so pink and pretty and perfect. I don't think she ever had cancer. She said, but there is not a cell to be found in her body. And while everyone loves that, and I don't want to diminish it, the real healing was the healing of my soul. I was circling the drain. It had been 29 months. I just wanted to be dead. And that was lifted off of me. That was gone. While I do feel very sad about my husband, I wish he hadn't have done this. I no longer blame myself. I no longer hate myself. I no longer obsess about why he did this. It has moved me out of that circle of endless rumination. And the angels answered many, 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 many of my questions about him and what happened and how I could get past it. I came back from that. I mean, Rosemary died September 5th, 2018. And I'm not sure who I am now. I just know that I am a radically different person. And there's so many PSs to this. But after I came back from this, I began selling off all of my personal possessions. Literally one by one, I sold my furniture. I sold pictures. I sold just all the stuff of life that you accumulate. I sold family heirlooms and old pieces that had been in the family for a couple generations. And then I sold my shiny new Camry, which had been my dream car, red Camry with white leather interior. I sold that, and then I sold my home. And the home sold in 2 hours. Got in my car, a little slightly used Prius I bought, and I drove 1,000 miles to the Midwest from Virginia to start a new life.
Wow, that is absolutely fascinating. I need to go back and kind of cover a couple of areas that we went over just to get some clarification on some things, but that's an amazing story. Now, when you said you spoke to the original, would you consider that the source or God, or was it just an angel or messenger?
I believe it was, I'm not sure. It was either I feel like it was God. I do. I feel like it was God, or maybe the right word is the Holy Ghost. And when I called her Big Rosemary, people really do take umbrage at that. But I meant it from the depths of my heart. It was like, that's the real Rosemary. I'm just the image and likeness. And again, it's not that God is Rosemary, Rosemary's God. It's just that's the light and the love and the truth of the universe. That is the all, the I am, the great I am. And I'm just reflecting that. I'm just manifesting a little itty bitty piece of that.
Right. It makes me think of the term higher self
yeah.
as well. Now, when you saw this being, could you kind of describe what it looked like, or any of the angelic beings that you came into contact?
Yeah, that's a very frequently asked question. I was floating in the blackness when I encountered the original. And so I can't physically describe what he, she looked like, except to say it was like being wrapped up in perfect everything, perfect light, perfect love, perfect peace, perfect calm, perfect joy. I have always been prone to anxiety and fear. And I had none of that. It was like I knew I was safe. I didn't need to worry about my health or money or all the stuff we worry about. I was safe. And boy, is that a cherished feeling, just feeling safe. So I cannot describe the original physically because I was still in the blackness. As to the white room, I didn't see angels, but they were there with me. And they talked to me, and they talked to me with words and without words. And when they talked, like when they said, if you agreed to go back, you'll be whole. It was an infusion of knowledge. And, you know, in the Bible, it says in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. These were those words. These were the words that had the power to create the universe. You know, we all tend to throw words around, but the words spoken by the divine or God or God's angels, those are words. Those are powerful words. When I was in the hospital, for 4 days, the angels came to my bedside and surrounded me, and their presence seemed more real than the human beings that came in the room. And I can describe those angels from a more physical perspective, because one of the things that happened that was absolutely life-changing was when either Milton or his sister had to leave the room and I was alone in the hospital room, the angels would make their presence known and they would sing me songs. And the songs came with music, and it was the most beautiful music times a trillion. and they sang to me. And when they sang, it's like everything lit up. It's like they lit up brighter. It's like all the sparkles and light and beauty that encompassed them was energized. And when they were singing to me, I would sob because it was so beautiful. It was again like trying to put too much voltage through a meager vessel. And I said, you know, I told the angels, I'm good with houses. I'm not good with melodies and lyrics. I'm not going to be able to remember this. And the angels said, oh, this isn't for you to remember. This is for your healing. This is for your joy. This is for your delight. This is our thank you for agreeing to come back, because we know that was difficult. We know we all want to be there. And that music, I don't remember the music. I don't remember the lyrics or the melody, but I remember how beautiful it was. But the angels, to describe them, I would say they were 6 or 7 feet tall. They had a humanesque form, as in head, shoulders, torso, legs, but they were not, it was more nebulous than that. And they were light. They were made of light, and it was sparkly, bright, colorful, beautiful light. And that's the best I can do to describe their form. And my friend Milton, I don't know how much of my story you've heard, but one of my favorite parts of this story, Milton had taken care of me for 2 years, literally lived in my home. We had a house with 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, so it worked out well. But he was my angel. I mean, he really was. He was my earth angel. Well, he had always been an avowed atheist, very proud of being an atheist. Actually got a magazine called American Atheist, used to show it to me. Well, so after he sees me die in that little ER, and, you know, it took about 2 minutes for the doctor and the nurse to come running down and, you know, deal with me and everything. He gets shooed out into the hallway. And later, after I'm out of the hospital and back home, I said, boy, you must have been really frightened when, you know, you've invested all this care and all this energy into saving me. And I just go and die on you. I said, you must have been terrified when they shooed you out into that hallway. And very, almost hesitantly, he said, well, not really. And I said, what? And he said, well, I had a few angels of my own. He said, while he was out in that hallway, leaning against the wall, waiting, you know, waiting to see what's next, he said, an angel came to him and said, we only need her for a few minutes. She'll be back. And he said, it was like somebody took a big warm blanket of comfort and peace and wrapped it around him. And he said, all his fears and worries just evaporated. And he said, after that, I went out into the lobby and got myself a soda. And I said, what? Because, you know, I wasn't in there to have strep throat test or something. I just died. But it changed him.
Now, did he actually physically see them, or was this kind of like a psychic communication as well?
I would say it was more like, based on his description, I would say it was more of a psychic connection. But he had a tangible feeling of being wrapped up in peace and calm. He said it was literally like somebody just put this blanket of peace over him, which is pretty dramatic. But no, he did not see them, but he heard them say, she's coming back. We just need her for a few minutes. And he was so comforted by that, that he literally walked out into the lobby and got himself something to drink.
Wow.
But the more remarkable part of this is I tell people he was in the blast radius. He was changed. And now it's been 2 years out. This is the man who now texts me Bible verses or spiritual insights or his favorite scriptural story or a sermon that he's read or heard. I mean, this changed him literally in the twinkling of an eye.
Wow, that's pretty profound. Now, when we're talking about these angels, you said that they were still communicating when you came to after, that they were telling you about how you would be healed. How did that work? You could still kind of have this psychic connection with them when you came back?
Oh, man, it was intense. I one of the things that challenges me is I want to live in that moment forever. And I still get stressed and anxious. but I wish I could live in that moment where I could talk to them and they would answer me instantly. I would ask them difficult questions and the answers were instantaneous. Living on earth is hard, and especially after you've seen heaven. But yes, I felt very intimately and instantly connected to them in every way imaginable. It was something I wish I could just live in forever, forever and ever and ever.
But it was at that time, like whenever you came to, that they were still speaking to you after, like whenever you were conscious, correct?
Correct. In fact, when they transported me by ambulance from that little ER to a pretty big hospital, I asked my friend Milton later, I said, was there an attendant in the back of that ambulance with me? And he said, well, yeah, there was a driver. And then the attendant sat back there with you. I only remember the angel. An angel was in that ambulance with me and was just talking to me nonstop. And at this point they had me hooked up to all kinds of IVs and they had an oxygen mask, not the cannula, but a full mask on me. And I remember the angel that was right there in the ambulance with me kept telling me funny stories and I would laugh out loud. And I would take the oxygen mask off for a minute just because I felt like I should laugh. You know, I could laugh more easily without the oxygen mask on. And the angel, I just thought it was so funny that here I've just died and I'm deliriously happy and laughing from this angel telling me stories. And yes, the angels were a very palpable presence for those first days and weeks. And it started to fade. And I literally would get on my knees and plead with God, please don't let the angels go away. I want to be with them at all times. And it was everything from 30 seconds before the phone would ring, I'd know who's calling. I'd know who was thinking about me. I was so attuned to the things of spirit, the things of God. And on one hand, it almost feels like it's unfair that after we've seen all that we have to come back and live here. And I tell myself, I know it's right. I know that I've had a couple years added to my contract, I guess, you know, but I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. And that maybe it's just, I'm supposed to tell people what heaven was like and that we can be instantly healed of, you know, it turned out to be stage two. We can be instantly healed of stage two cancer. The real healing, as I say, is that my soul was restored. And, you know, another interesting facet to this, at the time of my death, I had some high-frequency hearing loss, had some arthritis in my wrist, had a busted knee and a busted shoulder from an old injury. When I came back, those things were gone. Everything, it's like I got rebooted by the Creator. All those things were just gone and have not come back. Like I said, it's been 2 years. So I don't know what I'm doing here. I did write a book. I'm in the process of, you know, getting it published, but I'm not sure. It's hard when you see what heaven is like and experience that perfect peace. It's hard to come back to earth because it's so easy to get wrapped around the axle of, oh, he cut me off and oh, my credit card bill has hit me with a late fee and oh, this lady at the grocery store is just a nut. And I mean, it's so hard not to get just mired in that crap again.
Right. And that is, it's such an amazing story. And to me, it just provides such great evidence and, additional information that we can put towards the skepticism that people have of the afterlife. And I believe that, you know, if the scientific community would kind of embrace the spiritual community and learn more about it, we could have a much better world if we could integrate the spiritual and the scientific, because it is all connected, but they don't want to think that it is for whatever reason. I think if we could integrate that all together, that we could have a much better understanding of the nature of reality, life and death, and everything that we don't understand right now, if science would be more open-minded to the spiritual. I'd just like to get your thoughts on that as we close.
Yeah, it's incredibly frustrating to me that we force everyone in this itty-bitty box books of here are the rules, here are the medical rules. If you're dead more than 3 minutes, you shouldn't be resuscitated. That cancer has to be treated through toxic, poisonous chemicals. That you can't trust God. And I mean, it's the whole spectrum. And I mean, I have no doubt that life goes on. I have no doubt that God can heal us. I have no doubt about any of those things. And I guess I just live in that reality so much, I forget that when people hear I was healed of stage 2 cancer and they go, oh my gosh, I think, well, wait, the real healing was that grief was taken off of my heavy heart. My heart was healed. My soul was restored. I don't know how to get the scientific community to realize this is real healing. You know, this is a remarkable healing. There was one of my favorite stories. Oh, shoot, I should have looked up her name. But in Kansas, Leavenworth, Kansas, Alice, her name will come to me. Anyway, she had a very dramatic healing. She had a 38-pound tumor that disappeared overnight. She had been praying about it. She'd been praying about it for 2 years, even had a church group praying for her. Overnight, the tumor disappeared, and the doctors rushed into her house, and this was 1937. Doctors rushed into her house, and they said, well, why isn't your bed wet? Why aren't your clothes wet? The point is, the tumor disappeared. It didn't discharge. It didn't open and drain. It just disappeared. 38 pounds of tumor, gone overnight. And why don't we look at those stories? And there's a lot of those stories.
There are.
Lots and lots and lots. Why aren't we looking at those? And instead of saying spontaneous remission, I mean, I told my story to, in the beginning, I was telling my story to everybody. I told my story to a very angry atheist, and he said, well, you weren't healed in heaven. You had a spontaneous remission. It does happen. Really? From a point of a doctor saying that my flesh is distorted to the next doctor saying she never had cancer. You know, something's going on here that's really dramatic. So yeah, what is science? Science just means knowledge. Why don't we open up a little bit and see we really are spiritual beings, and the spiritual has definitive authority over this human condition? I mean, if not, Earth really is a cruel place to be. But I don't understand why it seems like our medical is getting more and more and more entrenched. Why don't we look at people's hearts and say, what is hurting you so much? You know, how do we heal the hurt? Because if we heal the hurt, maybe we can start healing people's bodies more effectively.
I agree 100%. You know, people's emotions and hurt and feelings are so much tied to their physical health that it can have detrimental effects. And, you know, we definitely need to have more scientists looking at spiritual aspects of this. And I think everything, the world could be a much better place. And Rosemary, I want to thank you so much for coming on tonight. That was fantastic information. If people would like to find out more about your story, about your book you're writing, anything else, is there anywhere they can go to do so?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm still creating a new website, but my current website, architecture related, has a lot of these stories, but it is searshomes.org. I actually write about the Sears kit homes of the early 1900s. So that is my website, searshomes.org. You can also contact me through that website. So it's searshomes.org.
Very good. Well, Rosemary, thank you again for coming on tonight. That was a fantastic story, and please enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you so much.
All right. You have an excellent night.
Thank you. Are we clear?
All right. We are clear. Yes. That was great. Thank you so much.
Oh, I hope I didn't talk too much or too fast.
No, that was awesome. That was great. I should actually have this posted within about 2 hours on the podcast, and I'll send you out all the links to everything.
Oh, please do. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And you have a great rest of your night. I'll send you over the stuff soon.
Thanks so much. Good night.
Good night.